My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the TechNet. For those who haven't heard it before, hopefully you've heard a few of those. It's a gathering of guys who are curious about radio and want to know more about it. And they come here and answer their questions. Gee, I'm hearing some music in the background, which is coming from the repeater. People come here and join their fellow curious amateurs who share information about how does radio work, how to make it work better. A person signs into the technical net by giving the three or four of us who run the tech net, that's K2RAW Dick, John KC2WGB, with the mailbag, some other things, Paul WS2N, and the space report, and from time to time we hear from Hal K6DBZ, who gives us what he believes are the more brief answers. So you sign in with your call letters and your name, and we take you in order for answering those questions. The group tries to do that. As you've heard before, we don't guarantee 100% accuracy, but it is a kind of peer-reviewed material in that various people review what we say and correct the errors. Every one of the tech nets get recorded. Let me drop it. Okay. The, I had a message given to me. Every one of the tech nets are recorded at amateurradio.tangovictor. www.amateurradio.tangovictor. So for the last 10 years of tech net, there are recorded. And various people will play that back, and if they find errors, they'll let us know about it. There's another, that first website is run by Mike, KC2NJI. It's Mike number two, K1MJM, that runs another TechNet, which is LimaTechNet.com, which has other supporting information, pictures and diagrams and articles and so on, with reference to the TechNet. At this time, we're going to take check-ins. So if you do have a question or a comment, please give us your call letters and your name. Wait for the beeps, and give me those check-ins right now. K2RAW, my name is Dick.
K2RAXP, John.
Yes.
That was a double. We heard John, IXP. Who was the other person checking in?
W-H-Y-Y, Joe, yes.
Okay, we got John and Joe, and I think there's a third person checking in. Who is that?
KC2LXD, the name is Rodney. Third place position, so I'll wait for another week.
KC2SHO, John in Mount Laurel, yes.
Okay, we got LXD, Rodney, FXO, Mount Laurel. And who was the other person who said that he can't tolerate being too many steps downrange? Who was that?
KB2L, it's Ed, and I'm going to have to go to bed before I can get at the end of this queue, so I'll wait for another week.
Ed, you said it so fast. Is your call letters W2L?
Hello, Bravo to Lima.
Okay. William Bravo to Lima. Ed, you're number one on the runway. Go right ahead.
Okay. And it's Kilo, K, Kilo, Bravo, 2, Lima. My question has to do with the efficiency of my transmitter. I got one of those plug-into-the-wall watt meters to see how much power my various devices are using. And when it's sitting idling, it's using 60 watts. When I transmit with a transmitted power of 50 watts, it goes up into the hundreds and hundreds of watts. So my question is, where is all of that other power going? That is going out into space as the...
Here is where the power is, so
understand what it's doing with the other hundreds of watts that it's pulling from the wall.
Ed, what is the model number and brand name of the rig you're using? Kilo Bravo 2 Lima, K2RIW.
The Yeti. And again, I'm transmitting at 50 watts.
Okay, it's a Yaesu. What is the model number of the Yaesu?
ST897. Are you having trouble hearing me?
ST897 of Yaesu. Okay, and it draws 60 watts when it's just sitting idling. And when you put out 50 watts, it draws hundreds. Is the maximum power output capability of that rig 50 watts, or can it go beyond that one? What's the maximum power output of that rig is?
On VHF, the maximum power output is 50 watts. It can go up to 100 watts on HF. And hundreds of watts. Or it's pulling, drawing multiple hundreds of watts.
Yeah, that is, that does sound a little bit excessive, without a doubt. 897. That rig probably has a whole lot of computing power. A very large display, if I remember correctly. And many, many functions inside. Many modes of operation. Is that true, First Ed? KB2L, K2IW?
Does not have a particularly large screen. It's got a screen that's maybe 1 inch by 2 inches, or 1.5 inch by 2 inches, LCD kind of old time looking screen, but it is an all mode transceiver. Yes.
Dick, WHCDL, can I ask a question about it?
Ed, go right ahead, Andy.
Thanks. Curious. Does that have an internal AC power supply, or are you using an external? I don't remember which radio has the internal supply. And if it has an external supply, what supply are you using to power it? Because I believe that's a 12-volt radio, is that right?
Yes, that's right. It's using an external power supply. It is a Pyramid model PS46KX.
Okay, so it's an external Pyramid supply. Would you know if that's a switching supply or a non-switching? I think it's non. Could you confirm that?
I don't know off the top of my head, but I could probably Google it very quickly.
How heavy is it? Gee, I just walked in. What are you asking about? Maybe I'll give you a fast answer.
Roughly how heavy is that power supply, Ed?
What's the question?
The power supply, your 46KX power supply, how heavy is it? How big, how heavy?
Oh, it's heavy. It's, I would say, about 1 foot by a foot and a half by about 6 inches. And the internet tells me that it weighs about 28 pounds.
6DBZ with a comment.
Yeah, therefore, I think Andy is on the right track here. That sounds like it's definitely a analog-type power supply, not a switching type. The analog-type power supplies, they usually have a rectifier and transformer inside. That's part of the weight. A transformer puts out something in the vicinity of 18 or so volts. The 18 volts then gets regulated in an analog manner down to the 12.5 or 13.7 that you've actually got it set at. So all of that voltage drop is heat dissipation of those linear transistors that are dropping that voltage. The reason they do it that way is because if your line voltage drops below, let's say, 120, if it drops down to 105 volts, you want the power supply to stay regulated. So they start off with a much higher voltage. Let's see if Andy can confirm that. WA2CDL, K2IW, go ahead, Andy.
6DPZ, can I make a comment?
Andy first, and then pass it over to Hal in that order. Go ahead, Andy.
Okay, I just pulled into the driveway, so I can't stay long anyway. I'm curious to know how much current that radio is drawing with full power. The power supply itself could have a problem. And the other question I'm asking myself is, how are you measuring the amperage or the wattage? What are you using to measure wattage? You know, how are you doing this? Because the power supply itself could be defective, or it could be the radio. But you'd have to look into the power supply, I would think, to start there, and measure the voltage, make sure it is 12 volt, 12.6, and then key up the radio,
And even on HF, with 100 watts, see how much current is being drawn from the power supply, if you can measure that as a start. So, and again, I don't know how you're measuring the wattage from the line. I'll give it to Hal. I have to go inside because I got somebody waiting for me. I just thought I'd mention that. I think I'll give it back to you because you're in that control. Give it to Hal and we'll continue. WHCDL.
QJF,
everybody
else.
KD2HUC with a comment.
Okay, Hal's asking what is the question. The question is a pyramid TS46KX linear power supply, we believe, feeding a Yaesu FT897. And Ed is asking us for an explanation for the discrepancy of the power drawn from the 120-volt wall versus the 50 watts of power output. K6DPZ, K2LIW.
KD2HUC with a comment.
K6DPZ, let me make my points clear first. Number one, let's determine if it's a switching power supply or an analog power supply. That's very easy to do. Take an ohmmeter, put it on the times 10 scale of VOM, look at your AC plug when you turn it on, measure the ohmage. If you got about 4 or 5 ohms when you turn it on, it's an analog power supply. If you have a very high resistance, it's a switching power supply. That's identifying power supply 101, okay? Number two, if you have a feeling it's a problem with the power supply under load, get yourself a couple, car salvage place, a couple sealed beams. Put them in parallel, pull them across the output of the power supply. You can draw a current that way and see if you're holding your voltage. Okay, that's the basic power supply checking 102. Now back to you, Dick. This is K6DPZ.
KD2HUC with a comment.
HUC, Steve, go ahead.
Hey, Dick, when it comes to power supplies regarding this, as far as efficiency goes, how important is power factor correction for these radios? What is the power factor on a radio? I know that, I was using a Meanwell power supply, and they offer two flavors. One has, I went for the cheaper one, but one that has power factor correction is a lot more expensive, and I'm wondering if that would make a big difference. KD2HUC, back to net.
KD2HUC.
Power supplies have power factor correction.
KE2EJ, go right ahead, Eric. K2IW.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but what I heard from his original question is he's got something equivalent to a kilowatt meter. You know, there's all a meter out there called kilowatts. You can see how many watts you're drawing in terms of AC power. And everybody seems to be taking the approach that there's something wrong. Whereas from what he's saying, it sounds exactly right. I mean, let's do a little simple Ohm's law. If you've got a 100-watt radio and it draws 20 amps, and you're using 12.5 volts, that's 250 watts right there. That tells you something about the efficiency of transistors and how it converts that energy into useful RF power. We know that tubes are far more efficient, although they're losing their edge these days. Transistors are getting better. But we're still not talking about high efficiency amounts. I mean, what's the ratio of 100 watts to 250 watts? I'm going to drop. And that's off the look. The thing weighs a ton. You know, it's a linear supply. Okay, as you mentioned before, Dick, you can be just cooking 40 watts with the thing got no load on it, just trying to keep that 18 volts at 12 volts. So there's really nothing wrong in what he said. So correct me if I'm wrong. K2RAW, K2AJ.
I think you're right on, Eric. The rig itself, because it's got sideband capability, the final stage is running Class A. Class A, if you were putting out a pure sine wave, Class A can't go above 50% efficiency. They probably run closer to 40% efficiency. So the final stage has got its bias current continuously drawing power even before you speak into the microphone. So you got the significant inefficiency well below 50% in the transmitter itself. The linear power supply has another significant power factor. Now, power factor is not the right word. Inefficiency, because it puts out something in the vicinity of 18, 19 volts into its regulator, and the regulator regulates it down to 12 with pure resistive voltage drop in the regulator transistors. So the combination of the inefficiency of the rig, which is proper, the inefficiency of a non-switching power supply, which is proper, you put that all together, and a couple of hundred watts goes in for 100 watts output capability on the HF bands and 50 watts output capability on the VHF bands. So what you're seeing, it could very well be completely proper. You can confirm the power. Let me drop it. By way of a bird watt meter, you could confirm the RF output going to the antenna. By way of an ammeter, you could confirm the current being drawn on the 12-volt power supply. Let's assume that your 12-volt power supply is putting out 13.7, and Eric estimated it might be drawing 20 amperes, so you can calculate how much power is really going into the rig. By way of your kilowatt meter, you know how much AC power is going into your linear power supply, and from the pounds you described, there's a high probability your power supply is linear. If it was a switching type power supply, they sometimes can get up to 85-90% efficiency. Linear type power supplies run a lot closer to 50%. So as Eric is saying, quite possibly everything you've seen is exactly the way it's supposed to be. Kilo Bravo 2 Lima, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, KB2L, that sounds very reasonable to me. And really, I think the answer, you know, to the bulk of my question has to do with what Eric was saying about the inherent inefficiency of the transistors that are being used, and that, you know, just a certain amount of heat gets burned, energy gets burned as heat, you know, whenever we are doing work with these transistors, and particularly when we're trying to amplify a signal. So I think that makes a lot of sense, and yes, it is a kilowatt. And now that I am, just for reference, now that I am keying down and talking, I plugged it in, and I am drawing 200 watts compared to my 60 watts when the radio is idle. So, okay, thank you for answering my question, and thank you for bumping me up the bed nice and early. K2RIW and the TechNet, this is KB2L.
Let me throw one more thing at you.
Yeah, from what we've heard so far, and it looks like you don't have to lose any sleep over this one, pun intended. KE2EJ, K2IW, go ahead with your further comment, Eric.
Now, the one thing I was going to suggest is that when the radio is in receive mode, and you have the speaker turned down, that this thing generally draws like 300-400 milliamps. So let's just say it draws an amp. So if it draws an amp, multiply that by 12.5 volts, you get 12.5 watts. So you know that if you're reading 60 watts with the radio just in receive mode, you're losing 30-odd watts from the power supply. Simple arithmetic. You can figure that out. K2J. Back to K2RIW.
Yeah, you could make this an interesting science experiment if you wanted to, Ed, by measuring the current on the 12-volt lead going into the rig and measuring the voltage. You'll know how much real power the transmitter is consuming. Your kilowatt meter is telling you how much power is going into the linear regulated power supply. The next step beyond that would be to use calorimetry. If you really wanted to confirm all of this, you could find out in the long run how much heat is coming out of the rig and how much heat is coming out of the power supply. I'll admit that those measurements would require a foam box, a thermometer, and various ways of really measuring calorimetry, how fast the temperature rises, if you know what I mean, if you wanted to go the next step. But from everything we're hearing, many of the rigs were all running, fall into that exact category, and it looks like no error is being displayed, and it looks like there's no fault for you to correct from all we can tell. KB2L for any final. K2RIW in the TechNet.
It's a fellow QHUC with a question.
I could put the radio in a plastic bag, fill up the bathtub, and measure the temperature change in the water. But that's a level of ambition that I do not aspire to. Thank you very much for your help, and I'll listen for as long as I can. K2RIW, KD2L.
Okay, KD2HUC. Go ahead with your further questions, Steve. K2RIW.
Back to my original question, Dick. If K2RIW was going to pick out a power supply, a switching power supply to power his rig, would he spend the extra dollars for significant power factor correction or not? How important would it be for our hobby? KD2HUC.
It's on the application.
Yeah, go ahead, Eric. You've got some comment on this. You bought lots of things that have power supply, a power factor correction, because you consume tremendous numbers of kilowatts in your broadcast station. Your Long Island Lighting Company, or its equivalent, forces you into power factor correction. We amateurs do not require that, is my belief. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Actually, my power supply is one of my transmitters. It has actual power factor correction numbers on it. The reason for that is because it's a very highly inductive supply, and it makes the meter a little bit silly. It does actually, if you look, and actually at the moment I have to have a power monitor because I'm trying to discover why PSE&G puts little 80 microsecond, 100 microsecond holes in the damn power coming in. But the point is, there's a three-phase supply. One minute, drop. So in a commercial environment, and if you're doing something that's medical or something that's got to be 100% service, you will find numbers like that. And generally, you usually find it associated with three-phase systems. You generally won't find them in the normal switching supplies, like if you bought an AC-DC supply or a Power One supply. If you ask for the information, they will give it to you, because all these supplies, these switching supplies, do actually appear as inductive loads, but you don't have any phasing relationships to worry about because they're single-phase supplies, and that's why they just don't bother and nobody really cares. And when you get into big stuff, then it becomes important.
I've got a question for you, Eric. Do you have reason to believe that the kilowatt measuring device, that brand name, can properly handle power factor? In other words, if there is a significant phase shift in the current versus voltage being drawn by the linear regulated power supply with this transformer input, would the kilowatt device be measuring volt amperes reactive, or would it really be measuring true power consumed? What's your guess on that one, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Now, I played with them, that's why I know about them. They're very simple devices. They don't compensate for any kind of phase shift. They're single phase devices, and they basically don't care. It's basically power conserved.
Okay. When you're using a linear regulated type power supply with a great big power transformer input, and maybe that power transformer is capable of feeding 40 amperes at 12 volts, therefore, when you're only drawing a small number of amperes because your transceiver is in the receive mode, the majority of what you're seeing is primary reactive current of that transformer. Therefore, the volt amperes can be a big number, but the real watts consumed will be a much smaller number. In this particular case, because of a highly reactive primary winding of a transformer, is it possible the kilowatt device is reading a higher number of watts than is really being consumed? Is it possibly reading volt amperes? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2JL. There is a little brochure that comes with it. They tell you about inductive loads in sort of a plain English way to say that you're going to get different readings from different kinds of devices. So, you know, I never did pull it apart to see how it works because, you know, when we think of the kilowatt hour meter, we think of using magnetic energy. I can think of a couple of dozen ways of doing it without having to put it into a resistive load or something that we would make a current measurement with, you know, some form of chunk and then figure out the math. But
thing to meter, so it could be done any different number of ways, but I suspect it's just a shunt and a pair of inputs and a little bit of a microprocessor to figure out what the actual wattage is. So the program could have some smarts in it, but I actually do not know.
For that device to read true power consumed, it would have to know the magnitude of the current, the magnitude of the voltage, and the phase angle between the two. Do you have reason to believe that Kilowatt is putting in the extra circuitry to measure phase angle, other than 0 degrees, so to speak? In the worst case, 90 degrees of phase angle would be pure reactive power. You know, you put a perfect inductor across the 110-volt power supply, you'll draw some current, but no power is being consumed, and the current would be very close to 90 degrees away from the voltage. So, do you think there's enough circuitry in there where they stand the chance of measuring that phase angle, Eric? If not, most likely it is just measuring pure volt amperes, therefore it's giving a pessimistic number. Does the brochure lead you to... No, of course not. The brochure would try to make the product sound as positive as possible. They may not tell you that it can read high in a reactive load. KE2EJ, K2IW.
No, I don't think so. The 6990 and the little teeny box that it is, it's probably got a single chip microprocessor with a, you know, a specific program burned into it that costs like $1.29. No, I don't think it's got that much smarts in it.
Okay, to go to the next step in Steve's question, HUC. If you are a big power consumer, like you're running a factory or you're running a broadcast station, your local power company will force you into power factor correction. In other words, because you've got a lot of inductive machinery running great big motors in your factory, your phase angle may be very far away from 0 degrees, the desirable number. You may be running a 45-degree phase angle because you're running a lot of inductive rotary machinery. Therefore, the current you draw is a lot higher than the current you would draw if you had power factor correction. And Long Island Lighting Company runs pure watt-hour meters. The watt-hour meters corrects for power factor. The watt-hour meter outside your house is a very sophisticated device. It tells the real energy you have consumed. It doesn't just simply measure current and voltage and multiply the two together. You'll get a pessimistically high number when you do that, because the extra current that you might be drawing in your factory causes extra voltage drop of their wiring, and they don't collect any dollars for that. They want you to do power factor correcting, and if you don't, they will charge you a premium charge in dollars per kilowatt hour, if you know what I mean. So when it comes to running a factory, power factor correction, let me drop it. If you're a big power consumer, and whether or not you pay the premium price or not with your local power company, which is a function of whether or not you're doing power factor correction, that makes a big difference in dollars. For you, the home consumer, if you bought a power supply with power factor correcting, and the total power you and I consume in our house is very small compared to a factory, do you, the consumer, get any benefit out of buying a power supply with power factor correction? I think the answer is no. Your watt-hour meter is going to tell the truth, the little bit of phase shift that your power supply creates compared to the rest of the load of your house. The big load items in your house are your air conditioning, your refrigeration, your electric range. The electric range, for instance, is a pure resistive load. The air conditioning, that could be somewhat reactive depending on the design of its compressor motor. So as I see it, should a home consumer buy power factor corrected power supplies and pay the extra bucks? I say no. You get no real benefit from it. Anybody has any further comments on that, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW and the TechNet. Okay, I think that was educational. Mr. IXP, I think it's KC2IXP. I forgot your prefix there, John. Go right ahead with your question. K2LIW and the TechNet.
Was he number two?
K K2IXP was number one. RYY is number two. Mr. IXP, go right ahead, John.
Thank you, Dick. Well, let me let this drop. It's Kilo Delta 2, India X-ray Papa. I have a question on a simple receive question. Nothing to do with transmitting. I have a monitor antenna, an old antenna specialist, monitor 56 model. I'd like to put it in the attic and attach it to my Bearcat 8500 using some leftover cable TV cable, 75 ohm. Now I know ideally it should be 50 ohm, but is that going to make a big difference on receiving? Just using the difference between the 75 ohm and a 50 ohm cable.
If you want the quick answer, the answer is no. Tell me if you want the more complicated answer. Over to you, John.
Thank you, Dick. I'm not getting any younger. I'll take the quick answer.
Unusual. I was being a little bit facetious when I said that. But your receiver, very rarely is a receiver exactly a 50 ohm load. And using 50 ohm cable would be ideal. 75 ohm cable and a 50 ohm load, if you had it, is a 1.5 standing wave ratio. That's a very little difference. A 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, in the worst case, can only lose you half a dB. No matter what the loss is of the cable, if you know what I mean. So 75 versus 50, no sweat. Even on transmitting. You're listening to me right now through a piece of 75 ohm hardline cable. That's what I use. I've got a 50 ohm antenna. I've got a 50 ohm transmitter. I'm using 75 ohm hardline because the price was right. And the 75 ohm cable, by the way, has lower loss than 50 ohm cable of the same diameter. So even though there's a little bit of standing wave ratio on each end, you come out ahead. Not to worry on that one, John. Go ahead and do it. As long as the cable doesn't have water in it, it should work like a charm. To B2RYY, Joe, what's the latest in your neighborhood? K2RYW, you've got a joke.
Good evening, Dick. How you doing? I recently saw a movie, circa 1937, about Amelia Earhart. And what they depicted in the movie at the end as they're looking for was a receiver, and I didn't see the model number of the receiver. But the interesting thing about it was it had two Western Electric meters on it, and they were calibrated from 10 decibels to 120 decibels above a microvolt. It said that on the scale of 1 meter, and the second meter to the right of it was a zero center, plus 6 decibels to the right and minus 10 decibels to the left. You think this is a Hollywood thing or a receiver ever existed like that? That's a very, very wide dynamic range, don't you think?
It sure is. So I think you're saying the lowest end of the scale was 10 dB above a microvolt and the top was 100. A microvolt is minus 107 dBm. 10 dB above that is minus 97. By modern standards, that's a pretty dead receiver. But way back then in the late 30s, I don't think Mr. Fries, F-R-I-I-S, had yet written his book from Bell Laboratories about a factor called noise figure. They weren't measuring noise figure in those days. They were measuring receiver sensitivity in microvolts. Various brand names will say, my receiver goes down to X number of microvolts. It was really using a more narrow IF strip. You make the IF strip more and more narrow, your receiver threshold, if you did, they didn't do cyanide measurings in those days either. Let me drop it. You do a simple microvolt sensitivity rating with a steady signal generator without any modulation, you know, with a 20 dB of quieting, so to speak, and you come up with very desirable numbers if you've got a very narrow IF strip. Unfortunately, you listen to AM broadcast, you listen to an AM modulated signal to a very narrow IF signal, a very IF bandwidth, and it's going to sound like the person is talking to you through a bale of cotton well, the high frequency notes are gone and the intelligibility goes down. So they hadn't measured noise figure yet to correct for these factors. They were just measuring noise figure. They were just measuring sensitivity in microvolts. And so the possibility exists that that microvolt meter might be real. And would it really go to 100 dB over a microvolt? If it's got a whole lot of automatic gain control function, yes. You may be saturating some of the front end stages, but the possibility exists that that first meter you described could be...
Repeater, timeout.
I see a slim possibility, Joe, that that first meter could be real. And if we have anybody who's an antique receiver collector, and this is probably an aircraft receiver, and by the way, one of the things that people who are somewhat derogatory of Amelia Earhart were worrying about was the fact that she had very little radio training. She didn't realize that life and death depended on whether or not that radio work could guide her into Howland Island or wherever she's trying to go. You get this little bit of an island and a great big zillions of square miles of Pacific Ocean. She's got to hit that island or end up in the water. And the only way she can hit that island is extremely good navigation and or radio location. And she was, by many people's standards, a very poor radio operator. Various people wanted to give her training before she took off on that flight, and she didn't want to spend the time doing radio training. So on top of that, whether or not she had a good operating antenna at the time is another big question. W2LYY, K2LIW, go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, you said 100 on the top scale. It's 120. It was 10 decibels above a microvolt to 120 above a microvolt. That's a tremendous range. That's more than 0 dBm at the top end of the scale. I didn't think a receiver existed. That's better than a spectrum analyzer can do as far as, you know, simple dynamic range. That's why I just didn't know what this thing says. You know, if this thing was real or something made up by, you know, like the movie set or whatever. I never heard of a receiver that had that kind of dynamic range to be able to measure that on a meter.
If the photograph of the front panel with that meter had enough resolution that you could read those figures off of the meter, is there any way you stand a chance of finding out the brand name and model number of that so-called aircraft receiver of probably 1935 vintage? It would be interesting to research whether or not that meter, like you described, really said, could Hollywood have enough smarts to give it those great big numbers on the meter? I'm skeptical of that. Would they redesign a meter? I don't think so. I think there's a higher probability the receiver really had that. Now, would the receiver really go to that upper 120 dB above a microvolt without saturating and still sound good with good clean audio out of the loudspeaker? That's another whole question. But if you happen to be testing that receiver on the airport, you know, you're doing a quick test in the airport, the control tower is talking to you, and you're 500 feet away from that control tower, you will get signals that strong. And so to be able to read the signal strength would be a slight confirmation of the fact that the equipment is all in good shape. I see some possibility that's real, though, Joe. Any chance of finding out the model number or brand name of that receiver? W2LYY, K2LIW.
Steve EZ with a comment.
Just a moment. First of all, Dick, you're assuming that they're running on the aircraft frequency. They were not. The depicted frequency that they kept on saying was listening on 3150. That's what they're using. They're using 500 kHz and 3150 kHz. They were not using higher frequencies as far as what they said. I have the movie on DVD. I still have it out. What I'll do is I'll try to take an actual picture of the thing, of the one frame of the receiver, because you never see a picture of the entire front face of the thing, just really a close-up of these two.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Let's see if Hal knows what that receiver could be. K6DPZ, K2RIW.
WK6DPZ. Helicrafters made a receiver. I'm just working from memory. It had a big S meter on it, and it went from we were able to see 1 microvolt on the meter up to, I believe, better than a couple of millivolts. About 200 millivolts or higher. It was on 1 meter. The meter was on the left side of the meter. SX-71 or SX-73. I have to pull the books.
but it did have a big S meter on it, and it did work. It had a dynamic range. It was a dual conversion receiver. The Hillcrafters had come out with it. It was in the HF range, Dick.
And your memory is at the upper power level reading of that meter, energy level, voltage level, was some number of milli.
Dick, I'll pull some information. I'll come back. I'll tell you the model of the receiver. You could read 1 microvolt, the low left-hand part of the meter. There's a big meter on the receiver off to the right, and it went up to a millivolt. Let me check my library down here. I'll try and give you a model number of the Hillcrafters that it is. Roger?
The main thing we're looking for is how many millivolts was the upper end of that meter. Over to you, Al.
It was, I believe, I got a point, Dick. I think it was about 500 millivolts. Had a wide dynamic range. It's a big, very large square meter. Let me see if I can pull the information on that. I can tell you exactly the model and everything. As a matter of fact, we have about 5 of them sitting on the shelf in the showroom.
Signals are possible, as I see it, Joe. And they didn't understand noise figure. They wanted to make sure they could read signal strength. Quite possibly they wanted to read signal strength when they're very close to the transmitter, Joe. And that could be real. My first guess is that could be real. So we'll come back to that subject when we get the further information. Next guy on the list was Rodney, Kilo Charlie 2, Lima X-Way Bravo, I think it is. Go ahead, Rodney, K2RAW, the TechNet.
Okay, the call is Kilo Charlie 2, Lima X-Ray Delta, and you have my name correct. Good evening, Dick, and I heard Hal in there. Good evening to you and everybody on the TechNet. And my question is relating to digital modes. I'm trying to operate PSK31, and my issue is that I cannot get my transceiver to key up. Let me drop it. Okay, and the equipment that I'm using is a Windows 7 64-bit, a Kenwood TS-2000 X-ray transceiver, and I'm using a signal link USB interface by Tigertronics. So that's what I'm using, and I understand there are a lot of folks with Kenwoods, and they're having success with it, but I can't seem to find anyone that would tell me what I'm doing wrong. I, adjusted the volume according to the map, and I can't get the transceiver to key up. Over.
Okay, so let's see if we have a PSK31 expert on tonight. And we don't usually have a whole lot of digital people, if you know what I mean. There is a computer net that's run on LimeOn. I think it's on Wednesday night, is the computer net.
After you're using the Dick.
Say that again, Eric.
What is he using for software that he's driving his interface with?
Okay, Eric, you and Rodney go back and forth to each other. So, what software are you using with your attempt to get PSK31 to work? Killer, you got it, Rodney.
Okay, Eric, I don't see.
I don't know the signal link. Most of the interfaces will let you select whether the PCC is high or low. I would look into the signal link manual and see if there's a jumper that takes the push-to-talk line low or high. If it sounds like you've got set up in FLDG setup right, it sounds like you're talking to the box properly. The problem you're having is just the interface between the box and the radio itself. So I would look in the manual or go online and check and see. They got to give you the ability to change the polarity because different radios use different polarities. It's a more universal box. So that's where I would go looking.
6DPZ, I got the answer, Dick.
Yeah, stand by. Let's finish this one first. Do you think there might be a reverse in the polarity of his Kenwood TX-2000? Is that what you're saying, Eric? Go ahead.
No, Dick. I'm saying inside the signal in box, inside the interface box, they usually give you a choice as to whether it's
high detachment or low detachment.
And the TX-2000 is one of those, and therefore the box itself is resettable. What would you run that one, Rodney?
Okay, well, they gave me the adapters that I needed to hook up, you know, between the signal link and the transceiver. So I'm using a 13 Denton that goes from the transceiver to the signal link box. And I told them, you know, the transceiver that I would be using, so they sent me a special module that's supposed to interface with the Kenwood TX-2000. It's the plug-and-play module. And I spoke to the guy. He walked everything through with me, so nothing was wrong with the signal link USB. You know, but for some reason, he did not understand why the transceiver wasn't, keying up as well. So this is where I am right now. I'm at a loss of what I need to do now.
You got it, Eric.
All right. Well, I'm sure if you look into the schematic and the book, there's going to be a setting to make it either high or low. But what you can do is you can find out which is the push-to-talk pin on the connector that goes into the radio. And you can take a voltmeter and see if there's voltage there when you go into transmit. Or if there's nothing there when you go into transmit. If there's nothing there, you can put your own meter on it and see if when you go into transmit, it shorts it out, and when you go out of transmit, it opens it up, or does the reverse. So, even though the salesperson who sold you the box, unless it was the manufacturer itself, just from the sound of it, it doesn't sound like it, you might call the manufacturer and tell them your problem, and they'll tell you to open the box and change jumper so-and-so to such and such a position. You follow what I'm saying?
Yes, understood. I understand. And fortunately, I do have a voltmeter, so I'll start there first. That was a good suggestion. And then I'll try Plan B, calling them again. So anyway, thank you so much for the support, and we'll let you carry on with the TechNet. So we'll say thank you, and we'll get it back to Net Control.
Now, make sure you call the manufacturer, not the, you know, the place you bought it from, if it's a ham radio place.
Eric, let me ask you this question. The TX-2000 has got a million menus. Is it possible Rodney should go to one of those menus in order to make the auxiliary plug behave the right way to do the right interfacing? KE2EJ, KE2RIW.
I don't have intimate knowledge in the 2000, so I can't really answer that. But I know in the Acer stuff, depending upon what you're doing, yeah, there's some settings. But generally, the PPT lines are all dang together. But again, I don't know the 2000. They could have a separate menu item just for that if he's going into the auxiliary connector. That's absolutely a possibility. But usually one phone call to the manufacturer will get you going real fast.
So, Dick. What was that, John?
KC2WQB, Dick on Echo Link. We have a gentleman, John, K2FQU. He has some information on that about the sound card and things like that. Give a little break and see if he can come on.
Okay, K2FQU, Foxtrot Quebec Uniform, sounds like you have some information. Start up for your name and your information, sir. K2LIW in the deck net.
K2RIW, this is K2FQU. My name is John, via Echo Link. QTH is Thomaston, Connecticut. I use the signal link on a 857 Delta for mobile use and a Kenwood TS480 HX, the 100-watt model, the auto tuner. And they're correct with the DIN pinup. The 857 and the 400, the 480 are identical for the wire. And then there was also a jumper on the board for the signaling. But what I recall when setting it up with Windows and in Linux, Ubuntu Linux for FL Digi, the the ALC or the transmit for the radio has to be low. Pardon. Let me just let it break for a moment. K2FQ. You with the TechNet. And also having the ALC low, so you can see it when selecting the sound card, it will automatically key up. That's when it trips the mic response on the radio with the pinout. So what comes to mind is if he has the correct sound card chosen, you'll see it come up. And Signalink's website, the Tiger website, has what it should show up as the drivers for the USB sound card. But if it doesn't come up, it won't trigger for it to send out. But if it's already set within Windows or the operating another end is to take a look at the connections between the radio and the sound card to make sure there are no cuts in the wire. And that is besides the pinout, the pinout from the radio to the sound card to the computer. If that all is correct, then it should just trip. But you want to make sure that the volume is set at a nominal rate, like 50% or even less. You can play around with those settings within all the menus. K2FQU, back to TechNet.
I thank you, John. Let's see if Rodney's got some further questions on this. KC2LXD, K2RW, you've got it, Rodney.
Okay, KC2LXD. Yes, actually, on my Windows 7, you know, when I made sure everything was set correctly, I am seeing USB codec and everything. You know, everything that they told me that I should be seeing, I am seeing on the software. But it, you know, it's just not keying the transmitter. You know, they told me how to set the transceiver, which I followed that. I followed the volume settings. Everything is right. Like, I can see the PSK signals. I can hear it. You know, everything seems to be working fine except for the transmit part.
Any further suggestions there, John? K2FQU, K2RIW.
It's in the 857 Delta. It was the... goodness, it wasn't the processor. Was the gain. Is the gain low?
You got it, Rodney.
Yes, the mic gain is set at zero. I'm not using the processor. It says not to put the processor on. It's not on. I can turn the radio wattage up to 100 because they say, you know, turn it to 100. And then you can gradually back it down once you see movement on the SWR meter. But I'm not seeing any RF output. My ALC doesn't move at all, you know. On the software itself, the FL Digi, when I transmit, I can see the signal on the waterfall, but it's no RF output via my watt meter.
Go ahead, John. And he said his mic gain is set at zero.
Dick, and then pick up K2 UPS.
Have a point. K2FQU, the TechNet. I remember adjusting the gain from up and down just to see any motion. You can also check to see if it's transmitting when you hear the signal link click. It'll click to show that it's transmitting. It's a pretty interesting, unique sound. But if it's set to zero, increase it just a little bit. Just, I hear a smidgen, like 1%, 2%, 3%. See if that might help with the transmission. Even though they state that, I remember reviewing all the instructions set and a few other blogs posted like years ago. I've been using the signaling for 2 years now, and I just recall playing around with the settings back and forth and even playing with the gain a little bit just to make sure that the ALC kind of moves a little bit, and then you have to have it under a certain percentage so it doesn't burn out your transceiver when transmitting. But it's good that you're seeing the water flow on your computer. But if you're not hearing any clicking from the signal link, so that you will hear it go click, 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 click if it's doing PSK31 or if you're doing RIDI or if you're doing Morse code from FLDigi. You will hear it, literally hear it. So my suggestion would be to try increasing the gain just a little bit under the digital settings if you have that option on your radio.
I thank you, John. I know that Rich, K2UPS, has some further info. K2 Uncle Papa Sierra, maybe in Pennsylvania, K2RW. Go ahead, Rich.
Don't forget me, okay?
UPS Mobile, still in Ohio tonight, Dick. I don't do that much digital, but it to me it sounds like it's something very simple that everybody's overlooking somehow, and it's either on the radio or in one of the settings. But does it need to have Vox on instead of push to talk to trigger it? I'm not really sure, but it might be something that you'd want to check that.
I'm looking at the website. It's real that it does the push to talk.
Actually, they said not to use Vox because the signal link has a built-in Vox in it. Over.
It looks to me like the voltage testing that you were mentioning earlier, Rodney, looks like the best way. Is the voltage going high to low or low to high, whichever it is, to properly key the rig through that auxiliary connector? That's what you have to check on. Hal, what did you find out with your research on that receiver? K6DPZ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K6DPZ. Okay, I went to the library, we pulled it. It's a model S76U. It's made between 1950 and 1955. It has a 4-inch meter on it that reads in microvolts, and also it goes to 80 dB over S9, so it's about 5,000. One microvolt to 5,000 microvolts, the dual conversion receiver. The first IF is 1650, the second is 50 kcs, and its frequency range covers from, let me just double check here, it's been a long time since I repaired one, 538 to 34 megahertz. So it does exist, and from what I remembered, it was pretty accurate, Dick. Go ahead.
Now, there's a big mystery here, Hal. You're describing a receiver built in 1950 to 1955. Amelia Earhart could not have been using that receiver. She took off something like 1937. Back to you, Hal. K2RIW.
It was a movie. They may use this as a prop.
W2RYY, K2RIW. Is that possibly what happened? It wasn't really Amelia Earhart's receiver. Somebody had something much more modern there. Over to you, Joe.
Dick, a radio that age should have had round meters, not square.
Agree with you, John.
So, Joe, did it have round meters and could have been a reissued receiver just for the movie prop? Over to you, Joe. Yeah, Joe specifically said the meter went to 120 decibels above a microvolt on the right-hand side, and the left-hand side of the meter was 10 dB above a microvolt. So it sounds like a slightly different receiver than the one you're describing, Hal. And I'm having trouble believing that Hollywood would dig into the meter and change the numbers, if you know what I mean. I don't think they would go that deep into a movie prop. Anybody have any further suggestions? K2RIW listening.
K2RIW. It's DPZ. Well, no, this is one of the few receivers I've seen with a 4-inch square meter. Hellocrafters made it. I have them. I've repaired them. And they really work.
Yeah, but Joe said it's a great big round meter. So quite possibly that movie prop, if it was, is still a different receiver than the one you're describing, Hal. Particularly since you said yours goes to 80, and he said it went to 120 dB above a microvolt. That was his main question. Could that be real? I think there's a slim chance it could be real.
I think it also had the wrong frequency coverage, I believe.
All right, well, this is all I got. This is the only one I've seen like this with this big a meter. I'm going to go QRT, gentlemen. This is K6DPZ. We'll just be listening.
Bye-bye for now. Okay, I think we've gone down the list of everyone who signed in with a question. I'll stand by and see if I missed anyone. K2RI, they'll be listening. Okay, looks like we've...